Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Welcome and to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find the club online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and on the club's YouTube channel. I'm Bill Draper, co-chairman of the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation, as well as your chair today for the program. The program will feature Robert Kaplan, president and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas. In conversation with Evelyn Dilsaver, vice chair of the Commonwealth Club's board of directors. Since 2015, Mr. Kaplan has represented the 11th Federal Reserve District on the Open Market Committee in the formulation of U.S. monetary policy and oversees 1,200 employees of the Dallas Fed. Mr. Kaplan was previously the Martin Marshall Professor of Management Practice and a Senior Associate Dean of Harvard Business School. Prior to joining Harvard in 2006, he was Vice Chairman of Goldman Sachs with global responsibility for the firm's investment banking and investment management divisions. I know him well. I know him as Rob, not Robert, and he also serves as the chairman of Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation, a global venture philanthropy forum that invests in nonprofit enterprises dedicated to addressing social issues. Born and raised in Kansas and a graduate of the University of Kansas, Mr. Kaplan holds a master's degree from Harvard Business School. Conducting the conversation with Mr. Kaplan will be Evelyn Dilsaver, vice chair of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors and former executive vice president of Charles Schwab and former CEO of Charles Schwab Investment Management. Please welcome Robert Kaplan and Evelyn Dilsaver.
Thank you, Bill, and welcome everybody for this afternoon session. We're really excited to have you here. We're going to cover the global economy, the national economy, and the local economy. So as you have questions, please don't hesitate to send them up. Otherwise, I'll dominate him with all the questions that I have. So let's start with the national economy.
And I may make one comment, slight prerogative before we get started. Just Bill Draper has been a friend, hero, partner for many years. He and Robin Richards and I chair the firm he talked about, and we've got Jim Bildner and Christy Chin, and we've been working together for many years. And so it's a real honor to be introduced by Bill. Always a big honor.
And Bill is a great supporter of the Commonwealth Club, so he donates to a lot of great causes. So let's talk about your assessment of the U.S. economy. Where do you think we stand today?
So here's where we stand. We had a disappointing first quarter. Estimated growth in GDP is about 1.2%, but it's my own view that we'll wind up in 2017 in the United States growing about 2%. Real GDP growth will be around 2%. So we think GDP is going to bounce back. Why is that? Two main reasons. One, the household sector in the United States is in pretty good shape, meaning households in this country have spent the last 8 or 9 years deleveraging. If you go back to 2008, debt to income in households was historically high. Over the last 8 years or so, the U.S. household has managed to deleverage, not because they've reduced debt so much, but incomes have finally caught up with the debt, and debt really hasn't grown as a whole. So because of that, the U.S. consumer, which is 70% of the U.S. economy, it's got pretty good capacity to spend. That doesn't mean they will spend, but they've got plenty of capacity to spend. And I think that's the main driver of the U.S. economy. In addition, we're getting a little bit of improvement in non-residential fixed investment, which basically is business CapEx primarily. And that's a little stronger this year. So because of those two things, I still believe we're going to grow at about 2% in the United States. Disappointing and sluggish by historical standards, but it'll be sufficient to take more slack out of the labor market. And I might just jump to that. We've got a headline unemployment rate of 4.3%, which is historically low. The measure I prefer to look at in the lingo is U6. Headline unemployment is U3. The measure I like to look at is referred to as U6, which is the unemployment rate plus discouraged workers, workers who have given up looking for work, and then thirdly, workers who are working part-time and would like to work full-time but can't find a full-time job. That measure is a better measure for me, and that's 8.4%. Okay, here's the problem. The pre-recession low of that measure was 8.1%. Okay, so historically, we've always had an issue with some level of discouraged workers. It tends to be highly correlated to people who have either have lower levels of educational attainment, either high school or less than high school, which is why there's been so much talk about middle skills training, apprenticeships, you've heard talked a lot about. But the moral of the story is we're near full employment in the United States. We could do better, but we're close. And then the last part, which I'll just flag and then we'll talk more about, is the inflation rate. Inflation has been notably sluggish in the United States. That's not all bad, by the way, for those of us who lived through the 70s. But getting to 2% inflation has been uneven and sluggish. But that's basically, in a nutshell, the overall assessment of the U.S. economy. We can talk about some of the reasons why it's been so sluggish.
Yeah, and let's get into that. And I know a passion of yours is around the skills gap. So could you also fold that into your discussion?
So here's the problem. There's two ways to grow GDP. There's been a lot of talk this year about, in the last 2 years, about how to grow GDP. Well, GDP growth is made up of growth in the workforce and growth in productivity. It's got to be one or the other or both if you're going to grow GDP. All right. And the problem is on growth in the workforce, the population of the United States is aging and people are aging out of the workforce. Okay. So the participation rate in 2007, the labor participation rate was about 66%. This is people of age and percentage of them who are actually either in work or looking for work. It was 66% in 07. It's down to 63% today. And we think over the next 10 years that the Dallas Fed is going to go below 61%. Why? Aging, demographics. People are aging out of the workforce. In the early 80s, we were talking before we came up here, demographic trends were improving. Most of us in this room, including me, were entering the workforce. Today, the demographic trends as the baby boom generation ages are deteriorating. So workforce growth is slowing, which creates a headwind for GDP growth. We'll talk about there are a number of things we could do to address that, but if we don't do anything to address it, you're going to have slow labor force growth. The issue with productivity is productivity growth has been muted in the United States. Why? It's not that we're not dramatically increasing productivity in almost every industry I can think of, but in order to get that productivity in every industry, workers are being displaced increasingly by technology. And when those workers are displaced, they're going from high productive jobs to less productive jobs because we've not beefed up enough skills training and helping workers adapt and get in productive jobs. So even though individual industries are far more productive, the workforce overall has muted productivity growth. But if we're going to grow GDP, we've got to move the needle on one of those two things. And Evelyn mentioned, therefore, the skills gap. So how do we grow the workforce and grow GDP? One of them is to get discouraged workers back in the workforce.
Yeah.
Okay, and the way to do that is to get them trained. Today in this country, there are far more skilled job openings than there's supply of workers. Recent survey of small business shows almost 50% of small businesses say, we need skilled workers, we can't find them. So One of the things we could do is dramatically improve skills training. The reason we don't see more of it, and we're seeing a lot of it, but not fast enough, has to be done locally. Worker mobility today is historically low. People are not going to move 500 miles on spec, particularly if you have a high school education, unless you're not going to move 500 miles to hope you can find a job. So skills training involves partnerships between local businesses, educational institutions, and nonprofits that agree on what the job openings are, either automotive technicians, pipe fitters, registered nurses, insurance specialists. You can go, there's a long list. And what they do is come together and form training programs and then hire the workers. It's going on all over the country. My point is it's not going on fast enough. Right. And so this is why everywhere I go, I talk about this, but it takes local leadership, business leadership, educational leadership, and people to come together, and they're not used to doing that at the rate we need them to. That would be one way to grow the workforce and improve productivity. A second way, by the way, even though it's controversial, is immigration. Immigrants and their children have made up over half the workforce growth in this country over the last 20 years. And in the next 20 years, it's likely to be higher than that. And so if you choke off or you don't have immigration, you're likely to grow more slowly. So while it's controversial, I'm also of the view we've got to come to grips with this at some point, again, if we want to grow GDP.
Now, some people, at least when you read in the press, they talk about globalization and they mix globalization with technology disruption. Could you talk about that and how you think about that?
So there's a number of trends going on in this country. One is there was a trend when I was growing up that people were leaving the cities. Some of you remember this one, going into rural areas. Now the trend is reverse. They're leaving rural areas and they want to live in cities. So a lot of rural areas, as we know, are struggling because of a cultural change where people would young people would rather live in big cities. The other thing that's happening is being attributed, as Evelyn said, globalization 15 or 20 years ago explained a lot of the job losses in many communities in this country. In the last 5 or 10 years, not so much. It turns out that this hemisphere is doing a good job taking share from Asia. And we can get to this later, the partnership, trade partnerships with Mexico, for example, have allowed us to become more competitive and keep more jobs in this hemisphere. The problem is, in the rhetoric, a lot of job losses are being attributed to globalization. They're more likely today due to technology-enabled disruption. And you see it in everything you do, retail stores versus online. But it goes on in taxi cabs versus Uber. It goes on in every single industry. That more likely today is causing the disruption. And the problem is if we misdiagnose this disruption or these job losses as globalization, we're likely to make poor policy decisions. And that's why I talk about this, and I feel it's my responsibility to talk about this analysis frequently, because we need to understand the impact of globalization currently,
right,
versus the bigger force right now, which is technology-enabled disruption, which it has many benefits, but one of the negatives is workers are far more likely to have to change careers, change functions, lose their jobs, and if they're not as adaptable, if they have a college education or some college, studies show they're pretty adaptable to dealing with that disruption. If they have a high school or less than high school education, not as adaptable, which is why we see so many discouraged workers in that educational cohort.
Right, right. And I think the other issue is that we haven't made those professions that you described earlier a proud profession to be in anymore, right? It was always college, you got to go to college, got to get your 4 years in, and you graduate, and then there isn't a job.
So the biggest question I ask when we do so at the Dallas Fed, we do lots of workforce development convenings. And the first question I ask is, well, this is great, but why aren't we doing more of it? And the biggest issue, as Evelyn just said, is awareness. You know, people didn't raise their kids to be a blank. But here's what you find. Talk to any automotive dealership now, most likely in this country. 10, 15 years ago, the key person in an auto dealer was the salesperson. Okay, that was the key person, and you better make sure to keep your salespeople. Today, the key person in auto dealer is not the salesperson, because many sales are being done online. It's the automotive technician. That's right. That's the most valuable person. because service is so critical if you want to get somebody to buy a car from you. And he's probably the high, he or she's the highest paid person. And so once young people realize pipe fitters, automotive automotive technicians, insurance specialists, and they realize that these people are making very healthy jobs, you know, in many cases over $125,000, $150,000 a year, all of a sudden they realize, I didn't know that, but there's a lack of awareness, and I think businesses know this, but I think among potential workers, there needs to be a cultural change, and we need to work on it.
So the Fed's responsible for monetary policy, but you discussed the importance of fiscal policy and structural reforms. Why are they key issues, and what recommendations would you have around both of them?
So the interesting thing, and this is part of why I came to the Fed, in my lifetime, and most of the lifetime, I think we're all similar ages looking at people in this audience, we've had fiscal policy and monetary policy in the United States, okay? And we've tended over the last 50, 60 years to use fiscal policy, and namely increasing debt to GDP, to grow GDP when we were in times where we needed a burst of activity. We unfortunately, or I call it at the end of the debt super cycle, debt held by the public or the government is now 77% of GDP, and present value of future entitlements unfunded is about $46 trillion. There's a reason why you're not seeing more getting done in D.C. Yes, there's polarization and all that, but there's not a lot of fiscal capacity because, and my own view is, we are highly leveraged and this is unlikely to be sustainable, particularly as we age. The only reason we're not screaming about it more is because interest rates are so low. So in the last 8 years, most of the economic policy has been monetary policy. We haven't had much fiscal policy in this country. Same goes for Europe. And that's why most of the economic discussion is about what's the ECB going to do, what's the Fed going to do. That may seem natural, but we forget that actually isn't natural based on our history. So there are limits to monetary policy. Okay, what we can do with interest rates and our balance sheet. It has a key role to play, but it's not a substitute for structural reforms. Immigration is an example of a structural reform. Skills training is an example of a structural reform. Improving educational attainment is an example. Early childhood literacy is an example of a structural reform. We need those. That isn't something that's going to be done by the Fed. And sensible fiscal policy, in my view, for things like infrastructure or incentives to improve investment, we're going to need those if we're going to grow faster. Monetary policy alone won't be able to do it. And so I think it's important at the Fed we realize that and talk about the limits of monetary policy and broaden out and say we need broader economic policy if we're going to grow at higher rates of GDP.
I know Janet Yellen, when she was here about a month ago, also talked about those very same issues. We have a question from the audience. When will the Fed Reserve start to lower its balance sheet?
So for those who may have seen it, we announced after the June meeting a revised set of plans for how we're going to lower the balance sheet. And we've got we're not going to sell treasuries or mortgage-backed securities. We're going to allow our balance sheet to begin to run off, i.e. as debt issues mature, we just won't buy new maturities to replace them, okay? And we are going to do it in a phased-in way over 12 months. So we've announced our plans at the end of the June meeting. It's my own view that we should begin the process, i.e. begin the roll-off, sometime later this year. And so my best expectation, it's going to be appropriate to begin this process sometime before the end of 2017.
Great. Could you talk a little bit more about the debt? You know, I was reading in the Wall Street Journal today an op-ed piece that said, well, we should just get rid of the debt ceiling, and that might solve the problem for us. I don't get that. What does that mean, get rid of the debt ceiling?
So I'm going to stay away in my job. I'm careful to stay away from some of these political and tactical debates.
Okay.
But here's the big picture debate that's most important. Whether we have a debt ceiling or don't have a debt ceiling, we've got a level of debt at the government level. So I step back. I mentioned earlier the household sector's deleveraged since 08. So that's good. Businesses actually are a little more leveraged, but I'm not terribly worried about it because the financial sector has dramatically deleveraged because of regulation. And I think businesses can be more leveraged. I don't think it poses a systemic risk. The one area of the government, and this is true of all Western economies, that is a lot more leveraged than 08 is the federal government. And the issue is it's not sustainable. That's why I'm sure sometime in our lifetimes, you're going to see more focus on entitlement reform and other actions. And by the way, higher GDP growth would also help us deleverage, which is why growing faster is critical. But so whether you fight over a debt ceiling or not, the reason you're having these fights that we've never had before is there's a recognition is we're highly leveraged. And it's going to be difficult to sustain it. And back to demographics. What does aging demographics mean? When I was growing up, ratio of workers was here, dependents were here, recipients of benefits. As we age, it goes like this. Yeah. Okay, so we're highly leveraged now. As we age, that makes the leverage even worse, which means we need to address these issues.
Another question. Mr. Summers, in a recent op-ed in Washington Post, said the Fed needs to look at signs of inflation and not preemptively raise rates. I know you've talked about that in your op-ed pieces.
So this is a big debate, and I mentioned it earlier. I'll come back to it. So I said we have two primary mandates of the Fed, full employment, check. If we're not there, we're getting close to being at full employment. And I see reports of labor shortages and tight labor markets, not only in my district, but all over the country. Okay, inflation's been another matter, and I think it's been more muted than we're historically accustomed to, and you would think at 4.3% unemployment, and even at U6 of 8.4%, historically we would have expected to see more inflation pressure. So why aren't we seeing it? I believe two reasons are globalization, i.e., particularly the growth of China as a result of the investment and overcapacity in China. I think that's putting downward pressure on wages because people tend to think about labor now globally. And then second is this disruption, technology. Not only are workers being displaced by technology, but shoppers, all of you in this room and all of us, use technology now to shop much more easily for the lowest price. It's affecting most industries. Either new business models are displacing old ones, lowering costs, or as shoppers, technology is allowing you to pick the lowest price more easily. Also, reducing pricing power. So the big debate, which Larry Summers refers to, is, and I would say it's a trade-off. I liken this to, it's a dynamic process. I liken it to approaching an intersection, for lack of a better term. And this has been used before, this analogy, but I think it's a good one. If you're approaching an intersection at 35, 40 miles an hour, and you're about a half a mile, 800 yards away, you don't need to slam on the brakes, but you might be wise to take your foot off the accelerator, okay? And prepare that the light may change to yellow. We would expect, with the labor market getting tighter, that there's eventually going to be more wage pressure, and eventually that will lead to some price pressure. Maybe not the way we've experienced historically, but that should happen. So that's on the one hand. And if you wait till you see inflation, experience has told us you've waited too long. Mm-hmm. In other words, if inflation starts to really rear up and we realize that we've overheated the economy, the Fed will have to raise rates much more aggressively. And history has shown we've done that. That has tended to choke off economic growth. So what we're balancing is trying to say, okay, inflation's more muted, but on the other hand, we're running at very tight levels in the economy, so we need to anticipate at some point we could see inflation. So my way of dealing with this is this trade-off is remove some amount of accommodation, but still remain accommodative, and then be patient and wait to see more signs of inflation. So we're now, the Fed funds rate is now 100 to 125. We're still accommodative. Mm-hmm. I think it was very appropriate to remove some of this accommodation. From here now, I'd like to see evidence that recent weakness in inflation in March and to some extent April and May was transitory. I believe it will turn out to be, but I think we'd be wise to be patient to make sure that the evidence in the unfolding economy verifies that. So people are coming out on different sides of this balancing, but again, the emphasis I would have is this is a dynamic process. You've got to anticipate and use your judgment And you can't wait for signs of overheating of inflation, I don't believe. I think you have to use some judgment, and this is basically a risk management exercise.
Great. Now, we'll stay one more question on the national U.S. economy. So we're kind of long in the tooth for having a recession,
yeah.
And the stock market seems to be very, very frothy, especially tech stocks. Nobody yeah. seems to be able to dampen them down. What are you thinking? Are we going to have a crash soon? Next year?
So in my previous life, I was very willing to talk about market valuation, but I've learned in this job, and I have my own private views, but I don't get into it. But what I do look at is financial conditions. And the thing I'm watching for as a central banker is not so much are the markets overvalued, and I've got my own views. And I've said publicly, if there was a correction in the market, I think that might even be a healthy thing. But I do look for undue growth in debt. Leverage, okay? So if I see overheated financial conditions or valuations, what I'm looking for is debt growth contained, or is it happening that imbalances are being created? Because we've learned from 2008 and before, if leverage grows significantly, it's very difficult to tamp that down. Right now, I don't see undue growth in debt issuance. We were a little worried over the last year about commercial real estate exposure of the banks, but we've had very strong macroprudential policies, and we've tamped that down and encouraged the banks to tamp that down. So my own view is financial conditions can change overnight. I am concerned if I saw undue debt growth. And the other thing that does worry me is the shape of the yield curve. So I watch very carefully the 10-year Treasury. And if the 10-year, which it is around 215, that tells me expectations of economic growth are relatively sluggish. Hmm. And at 100, 125 of the Fed funds rate and 215 on the 10-year, you know, I'm reasonably comfortable with that. But I think there's a point if the 10-year Treasury rate stays at the level it's at, we've got to be very careful about how we remove accommodation from here. So I think it gets a little tougher from here in light of that.
Great. Let's move on to the global economy. I know you have a lot of questions I had up here, so we'll try to get back to them before we end the session. So what's your assessment of the global economy, and what are the current challenges being faced by them?
So in the Western world, Europe, which is doing, by the way, better, but Europe, if you step way back, it's performing somewhat better, but they have the same problems I just talked about that we have. Aging demographics, high levels of debt to GDP at the government level, and all the disruption issues I talked about. And this is why the ECB up to now has remained relatively accommodative. Brexit is something we watch very carefully, but I think maybe potentially because the pound has weakened, you've seen while economic growth in UK has been more muted, I think it's turned out to be manageable. And so I think the net effect, if there isn't other withdrawals from the EU and Europe, I think our own view here is Brexit is probably a negative for the UK, but it should be manageable in Europe and it should be manageable in the United States. I do worry about China. China has been growing about 6.5% a year. Here's the problem. To get that growth, they've been increasing debt to GDP. Mm-hmm. Over the last several years, debt to GDP in China has basically doubled. Okay. In order to achieve 6.5% GDP growth, they've been investing heavily in infrastructure, including some infrastructure that isn't being used, and in state-owned enterprises, a good example, the steel industry, where there's already global overcapacity and their investments are creating more global overcapacity. It's my own view, and I've spent a lot of time in China, that China will not be able to continue this, and they're going to eventually have to stop growing debt to GDP to boost GDP, and that you're going to see ultimately GDP rates in China drift down. The thing I worry about, and we saw in the first quarter of 2016, is you saw significant capital outflows from China, i.e. people who live there know they can't sustain this, and they're worried about weakening the currency, and so they've tried to offshore their money elsewhere. And that created a significant amount of instability, which transmitted here into much tighter conditions. And so you've seen the Chinese government try to apply much tighter currency controls to try to keep currency there. And so I'm watching China and will watch China very, very carefully. For those who say China's turned the corner, I don't think they're going to turn the corner. And for those who think it's going to be a meltdown, I don't think that's going to be the case either. I think this is going to be something to watch for many years into the future, because they've got a multi-year transition from being an export-driven economy to being a consumer-driven economy. It's going to take not years, decades for them to accomplish that. And I think the world is going to have to get used to lower levels of growth from China, which means global growth is going to be lower.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
So I'm concerned about China. And then the last country I'll talk about is Mexico, which is right on our border. And I spent a lot of time in Mexico. I think the integrated supply chain and logistical partnerships with Mexican companies has been critical to U.S. competitiveness. And that's what our research shows at the Dallas Fed. And I worry a little bit now when I go to Mexico, for many reasons, the anti-American sentiment has built. There's a presidential election in July of 2018. I think one of the keys to this country is good, stable relationships with countries on our border to the south and to the north. We've had it for a number of years with Mexico, and I'm a little concerned that we may have a new administration in Mexico in the summer of 18 that is a little, in order to get elected, you might have to prove to voters that you are, if not anti-American, keep some distance from America, and I don't think that's going to serve the United States well. So that's the last part of the global economy I'd refer to.
In fact, I think we've had a net outflow of Mexican immigrants to the U.S., right?
The net flow of Mexican immigrants to the United States has been basically zero for a couple of years now. Why? Mexican economy is stronger. They have more of a safety net. They're making a number of reforms. Family sizes are smaller, and so we have seen a reduced flow as a result of that.
Yeah. So let's go then on to the regional economy. Now, Texas economy, how is it doing given the significant drop in energy prices? And, you know, what's different today than from the 80s, for example?
So the big change in Texas over the last 25 years is diversification. In the 80s, when there was a big oil bust in Texas, it led to a financial crisis and a severe recession. Today, the energy business in Texas is now, depending on what month we're in, about 8% of GDP, which surprises people that it's that low. It was lower a year and a half ago. It was down to as low as 6.5% of GDP. So part of that is a shrinkage in the energy industry because of prices, but a lot of it is migration of people and firms to Texas. Dramatic diversification, not just in Dallas, but in Houston, Austin, San Antonio. Population of Texas 10 years ago was about 22.5 million. It's in excess of 28 million today and growing. The migration continues. So I'm worried about labor growth and population growth in the country. Texas is bucking that trend. The problem is it's taking from other states in order to fuel that growth. So we expect job growth in Texas this year will be about 2.5%, highest we've had in 3 years. And a big part of that growth is a rebound in the energy sector. And while we've had a lot of volatility in energy prices, even in the 40s, there are a number of places in the Permian Basin elsewhere where you can drill and make money. In other words, the break-even levels are below current market prices. And so we've seen a dramatic increase in rig count and drilling. I think U.S. production at the end of this last year was about 8.9 million barrels a day. We think it's going to end the year about 9.8 million barrels a day. Wow. That is a dramatic increase, which is why you're seeing this issue with supply, demand, and a lot of volatility in prices. But a lot of that growth is helping Texas.
That's great. You know, let's get back to a question again on technical displacing of unskilled workforce. I have a question here. What's your view on universal basic income?
So the big debate that's happening around the world and here is the future. So it's referred to as, in quote, the future of work. You know, will there be enough work? I actually believe that the U.S. workforce and people are so innovative, and this city and state is a great example of it, is so innovative. We're seeing dramatically new ways to provide not only goods but services. So I'm more optimistic than others are that as workers get displaced, new businesses and innovations will come to the fore that will create jobs. But it does mean we need to worry about the safety net, which is what universal income is about. Should there be some minimum income? I think it's something we have to look at, we have to study, we have to be aware of. But I'm hopeful with the right incentives and the right environment, we're going to have great innovation in ways we can't even imagine in this country. And I think I'm hopeful that universal income won't be necessary here, but it's something you'll hear talked about more and studied, and it's being used in a couple of Scandinavian countries already.
That's right. That's right. Let me do a quick radio break. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California program, and our guest is Robert Kaplan, President and CEO of the Dallas Federal Reserve. I'm Evelyn Dilsaver, your moderator, and you can hear our programs on the radio and catch up with program videos on the club's YouTube channel and visit us on Facebook and Twitter. So we're part of that disruptive technology that we're talking about
here. But you don't get to do that every day.
No, I don't get to do that every day.
Interesting.
Let's talk a little bit more about monetary policy, financial stability.
Yeah.
Share with us how you prepare for a Fed meeting.
Okay.
How are they conducted? And
all right.
Does everybody get to say something? Or
Yes. So here's how it works. There's 12 districts, including mine, and there are supposed to be, if we're fully staffed, there's supposed to be 7 governors. Right now we're down to 4. 3 of the seats are open. So we sit around a long table. I have the same seat every time. I have a great seat, actually. It's right at the, there's 2 of us. St. Louis is on my left. I'm on the right. I'm at the head of the table. It's where Greenspan used to sit. But I understand because he had some hearing issues, he moved to the middle of the table and they changed the arrangement. But it's like if you have a big, long dining room table or kitchen table at home, we sit around that. Each of us comes to this meeting, again, scheduled 8 times a year. Day 1, usually come on Monday, and we have committee meetings. Day 2, which is Tuesday, we each talk for about 10 minutes about economic conditions in our district and our assessment of economic conditions in the United States and the world. And each of us speaks with Janet Yellen going last. Wednesday, the second day, we do the same choreography. We each talk for about 10 minutes about our views on monetary policy, again with Janet Yellen going last. And then the last 17 seconds of the meeting, we vote. And so a lot of people say, gee, doesn't it matter whether you vote or not? I prepare exactly the same. Your role is exactly the same whether you vote or not. And actually, our influence around the table, I've found you can be just as influential whether you vote or not. By the time we get to the end of the meeting, we pretty well have agreed after debate what we're going to do. And I spend with my team about 2.5 weeks preparing for that meeting. Truthfully, I'm always preparing for that meeting everywhere I go with talking to businesses. I probably talk to 30 CEOs a month, one-on-one. We do business surveys. I talk to groups of business people, and I'm doing that all the time, every day, trying to understand what's going on out there in preparation for this FOMC meeting where we finally make decisions. At the end of that meeting, we vote, we make a decision, and it gets executed immediately. We announce it 3 hours later. If it's a quarterly meeting, Janet Yellen has a press conference and she explains it. If it's not a quarterly meeting, we don't have a press conference. But there's no body that legislates this after we're done. Whatever we decide, it gets executed.
Wow. So what are the main challenges that you currently face as you try to normalize the policies?
So I just explained that process. So it puts a great onus on each of us because there is no body that reviews our decisions. I take it very seriously. Each one of us has a big impact. And so what I'm always trying to do is make sure that we understand economic conditions. And I'm very aware, And the biggest challenge is this economy is not the same as the economy 10 years ago and 20 years and 30 years ago. May want it to be, but it's not the same. And here's what I mean. We talked about demographics, globalization, technology-enabled disruption, talked about how highly leveraged U.S. government is. The structure of our economy is very different. What's the main impact of that? The main impact for me is the neutral rate, which is a wonky term. It's a theoretical rate. It's the rate at which we're neither accommodative or restrictive. Okay? That interest rate is much lower today than it was 5 and 10 and 15 and 20 years ago. Okay? And some people have asked me, so what is it? My own judgment is the neutral rate right now is between 2 and 3. And if you pin me down, I'd say it's closer to 2 than to 3. So that means that even at 100, 125, we're accommodative, but we're probably not as accommodative as people think. And so that's one of the big impacts. And I think you're seeing this also in inflation, where the economy works much differently, which also tells me that probably the natural rate of unemployment is likely lower than we're historically accustomed. What do I mean by the natural rate of unemployment? I think we can run an unemployment rate in this country that is lower than we've historically had without triggering inflation or without overheating the economy. Again, that's a theoretical number. We'll never know exactly what it is, but it's a judgment I'm trying to make all the time, is what is the natural unemployment rate and how accommodative should we be? And trying to keep thinking about what is the neutral rate and how accommodative actually are we right now. So those are theoretical judgments, but they're ones I can tell you I'm thinking about during just about every waking hour and trying to understand how this economy works.
Right. So besides the inflation and unemployment rate, what other data points do you look at when you think about this monetary policy that you're
So I'll put it, I'm not an economist. I'm one of the few people around the table that's not. So as a business, I'm a business person. So as a business person, like most business people, I think of drivers. Okay, so what do I mean by a driver? Aging demographics is a driver. Okay, I know that economic trend is going to yield, is lead to certain results. So I look at economic data, inflation, unemployment, GDP, but those, in my experience, are outcomes that come as a result of certain economic drivers. So what I'm always trying to calibrate is, what's the impact of these different drivers? Technology-enabled disruption is a driver. Globalization is a driver. High levels of debt to GDP is a driver. And I look at data and are trying to, and that sort of tells me how these drivers are working. So I bring that perspective, but I'm always thinking about what are those drivers and what other key drivers are there? What other key trends are there out there that are affecting the way this economy works? And that's what I'm always thinking about as it relates to monetary policy.
Well, you know, you mentioned you talk to 30 CEOs a month. What about the consumer side of that equation, and how do you get at that?
So we're doing surveys of people in our district. I'm meeting with constituents. We have representatives on our board that are in touch with various different, trying to represent our community. And then I talk to lots of consumer-driven companies, and we talk to lots of nonprofits, including those that deal with at-risk segments of the population. So I'm doing the very best, and I'm out there a lot. And we're inviting the public in to the Fed, including tomorrow night's a good example. We'll have several hundred people in, and I'm talking to these people and asking them what they're seeing. I ask a lot of questions, you can imagine. And so I'm always trying to figure out what's going on out there, and we're trying to access all of these segments through our boards, through our surveys, through conversations, and being out there in the community. And that's a job, you know, I'll never figure it out. You're working on it all the time to try to understand what's going on. It's a never-ending process.
So let me ask you, what attracted you to this job?
So I'll tell you what it was. I'd always wanted to do public service, and you never know when these. And Bill Draper once gave me some advice. He said, "Life goes a lot better if you learn to say yes sometimes." Right? Remember that one, Phil? And so I always had that in my mind. And so this came up. This job came up. And I thought, oh, my Lord, I'm in the East Coast, moving to Dallas, too disruptive. But I had Bill Draper in my mind saying, if you want to do service, you got to learn to say yes. But the bigger reason, I've been watching the markets every day since I was 11 or 12 years old. Looking at the economy and the markets, I was basically trained by my mom and dad. My dad was a jewelry salesman, but he loved the markets. So we talked about the markets all the time. So this job in that regard is a very good fit. And the last part is, as tough as the economic crisis was in 08, my own view was trying to normalize rates, wean off this level of accommodation, was probably going to be harder than actually putting a lot of this accommodation on. And I felt like if people like me weren't willing to step up and take jobs like this, where I've got a lot of experience in the academia, the public sector, private sector, I thought really people like me ought to be taking these jobs. Not forever, but making a contribution. Right. So that combination and Bill Draper in my mind caused me to do this.
Which reminded me of a question somebody asked here. As you remove the debt off the Fed balance sheet, what does that do for inflation? Won't that cause it to go up?
Well, so the studies have suggested that shrinking the Fed balance sheet is akin to some degree of tightening. It's akin to some level of raising the Fed funds rate. And there's a debate on how much. My own objective in letting this balance sheet run off very gradually is to do it in a way that minimizes the impact on the Treasury market and the mortgage-backed securities markets. In other words, I think if we do this gradually enough, I'm hopeful we can limit the impact on either of those markets. But it is theoretically akin to some level of tightening, which you would think theoretically would be somewhat muting to inflation.
Right, right. Another question. Thoughts on what can be done about entitlement programs?
So this is one where I was very liberal in my, or very not liberal, very willing to give my views on this before I took this job. And I'm very aware that as a central banker, I need to be careful not to get in the middle of these political debates, other than to say the one thing I've said regularly, I believe we're at the end of the debt super cycle, i.e. we can't keep increasing leverage. $46 trillion, and likely growing, is going to start to work its way into the current budget deficit. The CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, does an outlook, which I have sitting always on my desk, and it shows as we age, more of those entitlement spendings will get into current spending, and the deficit as a percentage of GDP is going to go up. Okay? And so there's no doubt in my mind that we are, as a country, going to have to come to grips with the growth of entitlements. I think you're going to see some coming together on, and these are controversial topics, whether it's raising the age, given people are living longer, or means testing, or other types of proposals that will manage this. And I'm confident that that's going to probably need to happen in the next 5 or 10 years, because the deficits are going to grow enough that people are going to start wanting us to deal with this, or wanting the government to deal with this.
Right, right. Could you talk about the tax policies or tax codes that are coming out, or
yes.
is that off
no.
the radar?
So
here?
here's what I can say. To the extent, so I talk about what grows GDP. I talked about growth in the workforce, improvement in productivity. Okay. I'm a believer that the extent that in the tax code there are incentives to increase investment, that should improve productivity. To the extent that we're more globally competitive in terms of our corporate tax rate, that might encourage people to source and locate businesses here rather than outside the United States. That should help GDP. The one thing, and I believe that we need tax reform. Here's the issue. There's a difference between tax reform and a tax cut that is financed by growth in the deficit, or by the growth in debt. So the challenge, which and what makes this so hard, is in order to do tax reform and limit the debt impact, it means for everything you cut in terms of rate, you've got to have an offset. And I think you're seeing the struggle in Congress is how to create those offsets. And it's very, very hard to do. My concern is what I don't want to see is a big tax cut that basically doesn't have offsets and just grows the debt, because my fear, it'll give a short-term bump to GDP,
right,
and then you'll have a reversion back to the current level of growth, except debt to GDP will be higher, and that will create a further headwind on GDP growth. So this is a very, very difficult topic And that's why it's been so challenging.
Yeah, I think so. And I know a couple of meetings ago, we had a speaker talking about eliminating all the deductions, mortgage deductions, state tax deductions, and so forth. Your thoughts on that?
I'm not going to give a thought on that other than
okay.
to say the reason this is so hard is there are benefits and there are negatives. What's an example? Limiting the itemized deduction makes sense. Certain high tax states, like this one, you'll find if people can't deduct their state income taxes, they might actually make decisions. Wealthy people are far more mobile than the rest of the population, and we're already seeing a migration of many of those people to lower tax states. So it's not saying we shouldn't do that, but I'm saying it has to be thought through very, very carefully, ideally in a bipartisan way. And the reason people say bipartisan, these are going to be painful trade-offs. There's no getting around it. There are trade-offs involved.
Right. We have a question about the local economy here in the Bay Area. Salaries for skilled workforce in the technology sector influence the housing costs. And, of course, that has gone up, as we all know,
right.
here in the Bay Area. What do you see can help to bring that down?
So this is a big problem we also have in Texas, but you hear it in lots of communities in the country. Typical housing supply in the state of Texas, and I think it's here, it's similar, 2 to 4 months in major cities. Mm. I think the last time I looked in California might even be smaller than that. So what's the issue? I've noticed that builders have had a harder time assembling land, or there's a shortage of land, but either assembling land, creating new houses. There's some local regulatory reasons for that. There's some risk management reasons for that. And there's also some regulatory reasons for that in terms of restrictions on lending. But I think we see this in a lot of fast-growing areas. Housing prices are rising, and it's creating a challenge to growth. And so I'm sure a lot of, I can tell you in Dallas, Austin in particular, I know in this community, the local leaders are coming to grips with how do we create more availability of housing, rental and ownership housing, and how do we encourage more building and capacity because it's becoming an inhibitor to growth. And I think this is becoming a problem. It's not just, by the way, in our two locations. I hear this around the table from most of the Fed presidents. There's just a there's a shortage of housing, and we've been slow in this cycle to create more capacity for people to live.
You know, talking about that in the 21st skill sets as what advice would you give a college, well, high school student today going into college in terms of the skills that they need to acquire for the 21st century?
So, I think you're going to see in the future, and I remember I was in a classroom for 10 years, among other things, and I used to tell students, you're going to have to be far more adaptable than I had to be, meaning you're far more likely to fire people in your career than I was, and I had to do it, but you're going to be more likely to do it. You're going to be more likely to get fired. You're more likely to work in an industry that doesn't exist 30 years after you go into it. So not only do you need skills, in terms of technical skills, but I think some of these is referred to cognitive skills, interpersonal skills, reading, writing, basic skills are very, very important. And I think even in the middle skills training for people who've only finished high schools, you notice that the best middle skills programs are not just teaching the job skill. They're teaching other skills, interpersonal skills, workforce skills that allow people to be more adaptable. And so we're in an economy that people are being forced to adapt. We haven't set up our economy to help them adapt. And I think for young people in this economy, I'd say that's the key word. You're going to have to be more open-minded. You're going to have to be more adaptable. You're going to need a broad range of skills. And you've got to be willing psychologically to get retrained. And I think that's something that most of us, even though your parents didn't have to get retrained in their career, you are far more likely to have to get retrained, and you should just expect it and psychologically try to prepare yourself for it.
Do you have good examples in the Dallas area, for example, of the community, the public, the private sectors getting together?
We have lots of them. And basically at the Dallas Fed and other Fed offices do this, we convene groups between businesses, educational institutions. So what's an example? There's a national program, I'll mention it, Year Up, which some of you may hear of. It's actually, I've been friends with Gerald Chatavian in Boston. We convinced them to come to Dallas. In order to get them to come, though, we needed 5 or 10 businesses to agree we're going to take 60 or 70 workers. We agreed to take 3 at the Dallas Fed. AT&T agreed to take a certain number. A number of businesses agreed. They then formed a partnership with those businesses with a local educational institution. They're now training workers, and they're going to produce 60, 70 workers this year, and they're trying to ramp that up. There are also other programs being done in cities in our state that are very similar to that, but they all have the same characteristics. Businesses have to get together, which they're not used to doing, probably need a convener like the Fed or some other institution, compare what your open positions are, bring those to the local either high school or community college, and say, we'll take X number of workers if you agree to train them, and we'll do a joint venture, and we'll even provide some of the money for you to do the training. And most junior college leaders that I talk to in our state, and they're glad to do it. They just want to know that the workers are going to get paid, either registered nurses or others. And that's how they come together. So I've written a lot about this, and I talk a lot about it, because I basically, half kiddingly but not kiddingly, say, if you're waiting for the government to solve this problem, you can stop waiting. They're not going to. You're going to have to solve this problem. If you're a business leader, you're going to have to step up. You can create these programs. And I think as business leaders learn about this, they step up, and they're doing it more and more. The only issue is, if we're doing this at 20 miles an hour, we have to ramp it up to 50 miles an hour, because the rate of displacement is, if anything, accelerating.
Yep.
But I think we're doing a better job in this country. IBM has famously done a number of programs nationally. There's been a lot of talk about apprenticeship programs. But I think the challenge is, it's got to be done in your local community, and local leaders need to say, we need to take ownership of this and not wait for somebody else to do this. We need to step up and take leadership, and we can move the needle here.
And is this the first year of the program, or have you been
doing
this?
This has been going on in Dallas for years. Year Up just came in the last year. That's just one example. But I think many communities in the Texas area are working on this. And the reason they're doing it is every small business in town says the same thing. I can't find skilled workers. There's a skills gap. What are we going to do? And by the way, every one of these jobs that goes unfilled means the business makes less revenue and GDP is lower. And so that's what's causing this. And I think the more of it we do, the more we're going to grow. And it's going to help. It's going to be a sign of a vibrant, prosperous local community that they get good at this. So there's lots of things local communities need to do. Educational, quality education, availability of workforce, housing, other infrastructure. This will be added to the list. If you want a vibrant local community, your community is going to need to get better at creating these programs. And I think you're going to see that more and more through the United States.
Yeah, I think so too. So we have time for two more questions. One, I just love your thoughts about the consolidation that seems to be happening in businesses in general, and therefore displacing a lot of workers. If you think about Amazon just bought Whole Foods, and what's that going to do both to the distribution and groceries in general, and all of the retail stocks have taken a huge hit. So,
yeah. So
curious about your thoughts on that.
Here's how I'd put it this way. I can't predict exactly how disruption is going to unfold, and I've learned a long time ago to stop trying. I'm not going to figure out. But what I can predict is it's going to accelerate, and it's going to happen in industries that used to... I worked at Harvard for a number of years. It's never going to happen to us. Never going to happen to higher education.
Right.
And the truth is, we now see various forms of online education that are getting better and better and better and better and better, until the point we just did a program at Harvard called HBX, and the ratings on that program were outstanding. And people said, this is the best class I've ever taken. The more that happens, even higher education is going to get disrupted. So all I can say where I'm sitting is you should expect more of it. The part we need to do, given it's coming and happening, is communities now have a greater responsibility to try to help population and workers adjust to it. And that's a challenge. I think it's one of the big challenges facing our country. You can't talk enough about this at every level. local, national, you name it, because it's gonna continue.
Okay, last question. What's your ideal job once you're done with the Fed? What would you love to do?
So I've learned a long time ago, and I got this advice, the best thing you can do in the job you're in is do the best job you can at the current job you're in. And I've disciplined myself for a long time. I try to extend humanly possible not to think about ever what's next. The thing I'm struggling with every single day is how to do a better job in the one I'm in and get better, make a bigger contribution. And the main criteria for any job I'm in, including this one, can you make a positive impact on the community? Can you add value? And if I do that, then I feel better. I never feel great, but I feel better. But I think you always got to improve and keep doing a better and better job at doing that. So that probably takes most of my focus right now.
That's wonderful. So you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California program, and our guest, Robert Kaplan, President and CEO of the Dallas Federal Reserve. Commonwealth Club is now adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Evelyn.
Thank you.